There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the house of cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today. In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
You can become an official Patreon supporter of my work here at Strange Planet Productions by donating a monthly amount through patreon.com/strangeplanet. patreon.com/strangeplanet. There are several tiers to choose from. Pick which one is right for you, but any monthly amount is greatly appreciated. As a sign of my appreciation, you can have your name mentioned on air during my weekly radio show, or you could have your name included in a crawl on my YouTube channel live stream. You could also receive episodes of my old podcast, The Rock and Roll Twilight Zone. This critically acclaimed podcast, produced in partnership with Chris Jericho, is not currently available anywhere else. If you enjoy this podcast or my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, you can really get behind me and my work by donating once a month at patreon.com/strangeplanet. patreon.com/strangeplanet. Thomas J. Colbert is standing by. He and his cold case team may have cracked a very cold case indeed. Do you remember the name D.B. Cooper? This was the skyjacker who jumped out of a jet with a parachute and $200,000 in ransom money back in 1971, never to be heard from again and presumed dead. Well, not so fast, says my guest, and we'll get to that full story in minutes. Now, let me see. Oh, I mentioned how to stream us on YouTube, the HOA. Let's talk D.B. Cooper. In 1971, a skyjacker with a briefcase bomb demanded a $200,000 ransom and a parachute. Then he vanished out the jet's back door and became an instant legend. Now, a determined citizen sleuth has assembled a 40-member cold case team, spearheaded by former FBI agents, to solve the mystery of D.B. Cooper. And after a 5-year quest, they believe they've succeeded with a fugitive at trail's end. Thomas Colbert worked in numerous story development roles at the CBS News-owned and operated Los Angeles station, KCBS, and Paramount Television. He eventually created his own national True Story Research Service, which was credited with discovering 19 movies for the big and small screen, and he's the co-author of The Last Master Outlaw, How He Outfoxed the FBI 6 Times, But Not a Cold Case Team. How are you?
I'm great, Richard. And I might mention to you, I pronounce it the French-Canadian
Colbert
way, Steve Colbert.
All right. Thank you for that. Thomas Colbert. Wonderful. Now, let's, for those not familiar with the D.B. Cooper case, and I sort of gave just a very quick sort of thumbnail sketch, because, my Lord, we are going back nearly half a century now, 45 years ago. And this was the age, I remember, you know, this period of time, there were just hijackings, it seemed like, every week going on in the United States. Just give us a bit of the backstory of how, who D.B. Cooper was thought to be, how he ended up on that plane, and just sort of walk us through the initial parts of this story.
Sure. You mentioned how many hijackings. There were close to anywhere between 100 and 6,200. I can't remember the exact figure, between 68 and 72. It was a massive period of hijacking. But this was the first one not going to Cuba, not going to Russia, not planning to meet a boyfriend somewhere. This was for cash. And this was a very sophisticated job, and it involved an amount of money that a paratrooper could actually carry without jeopardizing his flight, meaning his glide pattern. And that's what the FBI determined. He could carry 22-some-odd pounds of money. Nobody expected it. In fact, this was a time when you could walk on a plane with a cigarette and a briefcase. Nobody would check it out. You could smoke. It was a different time. And he took advantage of that and sat himself in the back seat so he could monitor everyone. And the passengers were not told of his briefcase bomb. This man had what he claimed to be a bomb in his briefcase on a short flight between Portland to Seattle. And only the stewardesses, and that's what they still insist being called, I've befriended all three of them, stewardesses and the pilot crew,
right,
were aware. Everyone else was told it was an engine problem. Very interesting. So they kept it inside.
Right. Now, how did the name D.B. Cooper come to our attention? Why that name?
He signed his name on a boarding pass, Dan Cooper. And when they went looking for this guy after he vanished, the authorities at first thought, well, maybe the bad guy used his own name. So let's start looking up Coopers.
Right.
And they went into police stations, and they went into newsrooms, and a reporter, depending who you believe, an AP or UPI, they're competitive even for this claim. One of them overheard someone saying, well, which one are we seeing next? Let's go see D.B. Cooper. And the name stuck.
Ah, and again, those are the days when you didn't have to have all the identification, photo ID, in order to get on a plane.
That's right. You could just walk on.
So at some point, the $200,000 in ransom is delivered, and the passengers get off, and then he flies off again, supposedly en route to Mexico, with just him and the crew.
Don't forget the parachutes.
Right, right, yes. He asked for parachutes as well.
Change. He let the passengers go for four parachutes, and that was brilliant when you think about it, because obviously he was probably worried they were going to give him dummy chutes. So by insisting on four, they were left to believe, He might be taken hostage. So they couldn't dummy him up.
That is brilliant. That is very brilliant when you think about it. Right. And then he goes to the back and jumps out. Now, where are we at? 30,000 feet? How high up are we at this point?
About 10,000
feet. 10,000, okay.
The height was, yeah.
10,000 feet. All right. And in the aftermath, I mean, do they find a parachute? What do they find?
They found nothing. Now, they did massive searches. First of all, this was Thanksgiving weekend, a long weekend, and he jumped on Thanksgiving Eve. I think that was a plan. He obviously knew that some of the more senior law enforcement may be off or away from the job, and it would take time. It was an 11-hour period between the time he jumped and the first searches began.
Yeah, that's a lot of time. That's a lot. That's a half a day. You can put a lot of mileage between you and the authorities in 11 hours, even on foot.
Yeah, and he also did something else that was brilliant. He insisted that he left it to the crew. You decide which route you want to go south. I just want to go to Mexico. Well, D.B. Cooper had aviation background that was determined by studying his statements to the stewardesses and statements to the crew over the phone in the plane. And he did not designate a route south. Well, he was smart enough to know, and we believe our Cooper suspect was up there for 4 to 5 months studying the routes of the aircraft. He is a paratrooper, pilot, both fixed wing and helicopter, very knowledgeable, and apparently even had halo jumping, high altitude, low opening, something that was taught to the special forces in Vietnam. And our suspect had training with the Special Forces and CIA in Vietnam, off-the-books missions with them.
And this
so
is
here
some...
is a man who says, I don't care which route you go, as long as I get to New Mexico. And he knew there were only two routes. One was over the ocean, and one was a vector flight right over Portland. That was strategic. Without saying which one, the FBI couldn't plant cars and agents at highways. They didn't know which route the aircraft was going to go. They couldn't be there in time.
And they couldn't track it with a transponder?
Not at that time.
No.
They didn't really have them at that period.
Okay. But why would he risk them deciding to fly over the ocean? He can't bail out over the ocean, can he?
Well, he knew by flying at 200 miles an hour at 10,000 feet, that wouldn't be an option. In fact, when the crew, they wanted to go over the ocean, but Sacramento, California, where the headquarters for FAA was, overruled them and said no. You go down and the approach through Portland, because they were worried in an aircraft flying that low and slow, wonder if they had a problem. They're in the drink.
So he must have known that, although he gave them the choice, he must have known the route they were going to take.
Exactly. It was brilliant. And he studied that route. He was up there for 4 to 5 months. We believe he told, we have witnesses, 14 witnesses in two towns where he lived under an alias. One of his 21 aliases we have found in his 45 years. He lived there for 4 to 5 months, you'll love this, as a Swiss baron walking America. Norman de Winter was his name. Now, the reason we know his name, not only do we have older witnesses that are my age, former boomers now, he was in the those two towns as a Swiss baron, and he was staying with the most affluent families. He was the guest at a ball in Astoria, the Admiral's Ball. They all bought it. And we not only have witnesses. In the last month, Richard, we found two old articles that the Astorian paper didn't even know they had. None of the former journalists are alive. And it was a pack rat. Our 13th and 14th members, witnesses, found the articles that they had saved, documenting everything about Normandy Winter's stay in town.
Thomas, before we get into how you and how and why and when you assembled this cold case team, you know, the I'm just barely old enough to remember the D.B. Cooper, and but there was It was almost like, you know, after Elvis died, there were all these Elvis sightings, and the media was just so transfixed by the Elvis could be alive story, and there were, you know, Geraldo built a career on that and so forth. But there was sort of a similar thing with D.B. Cooper, and as a former newsman in L.A., I mean, were you receiving, like, tips and your colleagues, all these tips about D.B. Cooper?
Yeah, I was the senior researcher at the CBS station in Los Angeles. And, probably every few months we'd get a call or we'd get a stack of court documents sent to us. Those were never easy calls to hang up. I'm sure you can appreciate that, Richard, when they come in.
Absolutely.
Everybody thinks they know who it is. It basically boiled down to people were enamored and in love with the idea of fame and fortune. But they were always hard hang-ups.
And, you're right. People became enamored with him, too. I mean, he became kind of a Robin Hood in many people's minds. And when you think about the ingenuity, I mean, something like that could never happen again with GPS and post 9/11, all of the security and so forth. Is that why you called him the last master outlaw?
Well, you've kind of touched on both reasons. Number one, they referred to him as a Robin Hood. Well, cops always corrected me when I said that. They'd say, you're mispronouncing it's Robin Hood.
Right.
And the bottom line is that Master Outlaw was another name for the actual character Robin Hood. Back in the days in London, 300 to 400 years ago in England, in the forests, the heads of the gangs were called Master Outlaws, and they literally crowned them like kings. That's what Robin Hood was, and that's a synonym used in his book. I use the term Robin Hood because, as you pointed out, some of the hippies back then, and even some professors and sociologists, called him a Robin Hood. and he never returned any money to anybody, but the title stuck. It really was the end of an era. This is, as you pointed out, before CSI, before crime banks, before cameras in stores, you literally could vanish. And he really is the last outlaw of the Old West when you think about it.
Right.
You remember the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
Oh, yes.
The end
yes.
of an era.
That came around the same time, about that same time.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the actual characters, the real people portrayed in the movie, was the late 1800s. And they commented, who are those guys following us? That was when banks decided to hire their own security people to track bad guys. That ended that outlaw era.
The Pinkerton men.
Right. And then came the Bonnie and Clydes, the gangsters. Well, the FBI threw in logistics and statistics and started tracking those guys down. That ended that era. This was the last bad guy before modern tools came in.
Did you have a bit kind of a grudging admiration for him back then?
Well, I may have as a teenager. I was just going into high school when it happened. I remember my dad at the dining room table showing me the front page and hearing about him. And like Dillinger and all those were my dad's bad guy heroes. I guess I sort of looked at D.B. Cooper as my outlaw, you know, that kind of quietly rooting for him.
Right.
I became a newsman. I dealt with a lot of good guys and bad guys. And then I was recruited by the state of California to become a police, fire, and military trainer in crisis management. It was at a time in the business when everyone said no comment when it came to the media showing up at a crime scene. In the 80s, they recruited news people to help train police chiefs and media people to unfold their arms and talk. And that's what I did, and I taught for 18 years at Camp San Luis in California. And because of that, and I will also say I feel I have a strong sense of justice, just like my wife, and we have been supporters of law enforcement ever since.
In terms of the official investigation into the D.B. Cooper case, when did it sort of peter out and it became essentially, well, they didn't officially close the file, I guess, but when did they basically say, that's it, we, you know, no mas, we give up?
Well, I would tell you that they stopped showing pictures to the three stewardesses and a passenger. We'll talk about him later, Bill Mitchell, a passenger in the jet. Those were the key witnesses. They really stopped visiting them, and they were showing them 10 photos at a time, sometimes every week. Then it went down to a month, every month. Then it went down to four or five times a year. I would say about 74, 73, 74 is when that big rush was closing down. But they had a task force, both online and offline, looking at this case, and that continued all these years.
All right. So then, when did you become involved in the case, and what were the circumstances that got you assembling this cold case team?
I got approached by a cameraman I've known for 20 years in Vegas, and he tips me two to three times a year, and he's been involved in some of my movie projects and breaking stories over the years. And he called me and said, I've got a guy here, and he has a little network of casinos that sources that tip him. He said, I've got a guy here who had to get something off his chest. And I sat him down. He claims to have known Cooper. And I'm like rolling my eyes like everybody that hears that story.
Right, here we go again.
Yes. But then he said something that I had heard from law enforcement in training classes for years. And that is, he brought up, but this guy says he witnessed the planting of the money on the Columbia River in 1980. Now, I would tell you, that's when I grabbed my steno pad, because I'd been hearing from law enforcement for years, no one believed that that money just happened to wash up on the shore and sit there for 7 years and bury itself, and it happened to still have the rubber bands on top.
Right.
They just never bought that story from the couple and their son. The son was only 8 years old, so I believe that they just didn't trust the couple.
And this was a small portion of the ransom. It was about $5,000.
$5,800, to
right.
be exact.
Okay.
And it was found only 2 to 3 inches down on a beach, and it just didn't make sense. There was a fisherman who fished there for 10 years every day. The only day he missed, he said, when he posed as Santa Claus. He had a long beard every Christmas. And he said, there's no way that money washed up shore. I was there every day. And then the farmers that owned the land would take their cattle out every 2 weeks to water. They said the same thing to the FBI. That money couldn't have been sitting there more than a week. So, but the FBI announced at the microphones, well, it appears that Cooper could have drowned. In other words, they went with the attitude that he drowned, the money came out of his backpack and washed ashore.
Washed upshore, as you point out. Washed upshore.
And his bones must be out there somewhere.
Right, right.
That was the philosophy they took. Well, that's what I was left with. One source who happened to be a drug dealer. He was working for a Colombian cocaine dealer in Portland. And he was retired, about to become a grandfather. He was in the cocaine trade for 15 years in the 70s. Then he moved on to other things, but all these years later, he wanted to get that off his chest. So Richard sent me the tape, I looked at it, and I called this man, and I spent the next 8 months looking into his drug dealer. First thing we found out is the drug dealer had died, mysteriously, within a year. One car accident on a lonely road outside Portland. Then I said, well, we need other sources, and he brought me two other drug dealers, the middleman for the drug dealer himself and our source's drug runner, partner. Our source and his partner were ones that ran to Phoenix back and forth on cocaine runs. Well, they were at this party, in Portland, and their drug dealer one day asked them to come sit in the back of his Bentley. He was had a chauffeured Bentley. I mean, this was when cocaine just had hit. Cops weren't very organized. They didn't know the danger of cocaine. They hadn't even set up task forces yet. And so this was a time of exploration when it came to the cocaine trade. And so they were openly out in their, you know, their chauffeur-driven Bentley. And here is this drug dealer. His name was Dick Briggs. And he tells our guy, Ron, and his partner, he's thanking them for 2 years of work, and then he says, I want you guys to know I'm D.B. Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, both of these guys didn't buy it. He was shorter than the sketches they'd been seeing. And this, by the way, he sat them in the back of the car in 1979. So it's 8 years
later. 8 years later, right.
And he says, I was Cooper. And these two guys, you know, everybody claimed they were Cooper for the last decade in Portland. And he didn't look anything like the sketch. He was shorter. He was stocky. He was a weight builder. And they didn't buy it. Well, for a whole year, he tried to convince them. He even took one of them to the annual D.B. Cooper party that goes on in Washington State every year at a bar. And he put on a I'm a D.B. Cooper shirt, and he said, boy, I wish I could tell these people who I am. And again, the drug traffickers, well, yeah, sure, boss, was the attitude they had. And at the end of the year, 3 or 4 days before the money was found, this drug dealer is at a party with these guys, and they said, come here. Now, I know you guys don't believe I'm Cooper, but I'm going to prove it to you. You see that couple over there? And he pointed out what our drug runner said was the couple that found it. You see that couple over there? They and their son, and then he stepped to the window of this apartment building on the Columbia River, and he said, you see on the North Shore over there? In 4 days, they're going to find my money. And they knew exactly what he meant. And again, they said, sure, boss, sure. They thought he had lost him. And so they headed off on a drug run, and they stop in Reno. They're at a hotel at 10 o'clock at night, 3 days, 4 days later. And Ron is taking a shower. He's come out. The TV's on. And there is the couple, Ron says, with their boy on that Tuesday explaining how they fund the money on the North Shore.
Right.
And Ron and his partner decided they were, you know, they had an honor code, even in the drug trade. We're not going to say anything. And they kept it quiet for 40 years until that day in the casino when my cameraman got the story of his life.
Now, why would they, the police, the investigators, make the association between that money found and D.B. Cooper? I mean, were there serial numbers on the bills?
Yes. And thank you for mentioning that. Every one of them had serial numbers. While Cooper, there's some disagreement if he insisted on $20 bills or not, but what the FBI did do, they tried to keep them all out of the mint in San Francisco, I believe, so they had certain stamped, and they all tried to keep them in the year 1969, if I remember correctly. But that's all they did. There was no sequence of orders. He wanted them all mixed up, so they gave him huge stacks. This money had been set aside by a bank, not for this particular hijack, but in case the authorities in Seattle needed money quickly. The money had been set aside, so they wound up taking photos of the money, and they wrapped it up and gave it back to him.
So the serial numbers on the bills found by this family on the Columbia River in 1980, 9 years after the hijacking, they did match.
Exactly. They matched.
All right. And the people, do we know, was it D.B. Cooper himself or this drug runner who claimed that he planted the money, or did he get his employees, his drug running pals to do it, or how did that money get planted?
Well, we believe it had to do with the actual couple themselves. We believe Mr. Briggs was working with them. Let me just tell you how I got there. After realizing that there was something here when he mentioned this story, as I said, I spent 8 months looking into this. And we did track down two other drug runners, and we did interview them. We interviewed our first source with the leading former FBI polygrapher in the country, and he's one of the most famous in the world, Jack Tramarco. And he has now done documentaries on Dr. Phil, a show out here in Los Angeles. And I recruited him to give this drug runner a test, and he passed. And so we moved forward with that and started calling Dick Briggs' family and associates to find out, could this drug dealer, been D.B. Cooper, as these two men were told.
All right, Thomas, we are coming up on a break here. Thomas Colbert, co-author, The Last Master Outlaw, How He Outfoxed the FBI Six Times, But Not a Cold Case Team, The Legendary D.B. Cooper Case Solved, Perhaps. When we come back, we have to find out why 9 years after he disappeared over in the rainforest of the Pacific Northwest, why did he wait 9 years to plant that money? What was going on? We'll get to that when my conversation with Thomas resumes. Stay with us.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Guys, we've seen so many people making ridiculous money from crypto, but did you know it's easy for you to do the same? The Copy My Crypto membership site shows you the coins that the YouTuber James McMahon personally holds and allows you to copy him. It's like having a big brother who knows what he's doing. You don't need to know a thing about crypto or how to invest, as you simply do what he does. So let me tell you more about James. He runs the Crypto with James YouTube channel, which, despite heavy censorship, has over 17,000 subscribers and 1 million views. Since March 2020, he's told his viewers to buy 26 crypto coins. Had you put in $100 into each one, it would now be worth over $53,000. Of the 26 coins, his top pick of the year, a coin called Phantom, is currently up over 440 times from when he said to buy. That one call alone has retired a number of people, including guys in their 20s and 30s. Remember, this is public knowledge. You can go to YouTube and verify this for yourself. So, if you'd like to join the 1,300 members who copy James, then stop what you're doing and head over to copymycrypto.com/dollar. copymycrypto.com/dollar. That's D-O-L-L-A-R. You'll not only find proof of everything I've said, but listeners get full access for just $1. You can't find this offer anywhere else, but act fast because the offer ends soon. That's copymycrypto.com/dollar. That's D-O-L-L-A-R. Don't take this offer lightly. He's the real deal. Go visit the site now.
Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Thomas Colbert is with us, co-author of The Last Master Outlaw, How He, D.B. Cooper, Outfoxed the FBI Six Times But Not a Cold Case Team. Now, before we get to the cold case team, I've got to ask you one more question, and that is, why does Dick Riggs, this drug dealer in Portland who claims to be D.B. Cooper, why does he, 8 years after the hijacking, decide then to bury this money, to make it look like he drowned in the Columbia River?
Well, it turned out there was a crime partner he did it for. Now, I didn't know that, and the drug runners didn't even know it. They truly believed their drug dealer, who had the Cooper money, was Cooper. That's all they could think of. But I spent 8 months, and not only did we find out that Dick Riggs was just a party boy, I wasn't asking old friends from grammar school and high school, hey, could he have been Cooper? I was saying, could he have taken down a train? Could he have robbed a bank? And they said, no, he wasn't that smart. And I phoned his final friend, a frat brother, Pudgy Hunt, well-known basketball player in high school and college in Oregon with all sorts of records and a bar owner. And I called him, and it was his best friend. And Pudgy said, when I asked him, I was honest. I said, Pudgy, they're saying former drug runners that you know ran with him. were saying that he was Cooper. And he laughed and he said, there's no way he was Cooper. In fact, I think he was in my bar that day. Well, my shoulders just went right down. But then Pudgy said, but you know, I did introduce Dick Briggs to a former Vietnam vet. In fact, he used to be a D.B. Cooper suspect. It was on a floor job. We were laying a floor in California, and he went to work for him. His name was Robert W. Rackstraw. Now, I had heard that name. He was blown off because he was a Californian, yes, a Vietnam vet, but he was just ignored. And I looked into this man who was cleared by the FBI in 1979. Coincidentally, he was facing local charges in California at the same time that money was found on the shore. In between trials and bail, this man escaped not once, but three times by plane. And once, I'm going to argue, by river. He had, in one of his escapes, rode a motorcycle all the way up to Portland to meet with Dick Briggs. This was 14 months before the money was found on the shore. He had jumped bail, and a witness who happened to be the drug dealer's own son, who was 13 at the time, watching from a window in their house, he identified Mr. Rackstraw meeting his father on the driveway. In fact, he went down to introduce himself. And that's how he met Mr. Rackstraw 14 months before. It's our argument that we believe this was one of five meetings between Dick Briggs and Mr. Rackstraw, and this was one to plant the money. Now, as I suggested earlier, Mr. Rackstraw had some trials to get through. He didn't expect a lot of time. In fact, he only got sentenced to 2 years in July of 79. He was out in a year. But during that year, the money was found on the shore, and the FBI announced, well, apparently it looks like Cooper drowned. They were suspecting Mr. Rackstraw was Cooper. In fact, the whole year during his escapes, the FBI were trying to interview him. They absolutely thought he could be Cooper. In fact, I've identified eight different FBI agents leaking to local press that Rackstraw was being looked at as Mr. D.B. Cooper. Well, he's an incredible con artist, and he talked his way out of it. But let me tell you, when that money was found on the shore, 4 months before he was out of jail, that was, you might say, a find worth dying for. Because
right.
He was able to walk out under his own name.
In other words, the authorities were getting close on in identifying Rackstraw as D.B. Cooper, so he had to throw them off the trail, and that's when he decided to bury the money on the shores of the Columbia River, and that sealed the deal for the authorities. They said, well, no, that's proof. This is not D.B. Cooper. D.B. Cooper drowned.
Well, they spent the next year or two looking and digging and trying to find bones and more money and everything, and they didn't find any more solid money. They didn't find the bones, but by that time they had cleared Mr. Rackstraw. And he turned his life around. He hit the books after he got out a year of jail. He got three college degrees. He became an expert in arbitration. He became a professor at UC Riverside in California. In fact, he became head of the law department for two of his 10 years. And now he's retired, living in San Diego. But he's not fooling our team.
Is that his real name, Rackstraw? Were you able to determine that, Thomas?
Robert W. Rackstraw.
Rackstraw.
Senior, I might add.
All right.
Because there's a junior. There's a number one and number two that follow him. A son and a grandson, Robert W. Rackstraw.
All right. Tell me a little bit about the cold case team you put together.
I want to mention first all these wonderful slides and pictures that you're putting up on the website and also online. Please let your listeners know they can go to dbcooper.com. We actually own that website, and they can read about all this incredible 102 pieces of evidence there.
dbcooper.com.
Correct.
All right. Thank you for that. So,
as far as the cold case team, we went to the FBI after finding this connection to the drug dealers and Mr. Rackstraw, and the FBI passed on our 33 pieces of evidence because it wasn't enough, obviously, to get involved, but they encouraged us to move forward. We eventually got an email from headquarters after we gave them several pieces of evidence, and they said, we will accept your evidence. So we decided to create a secret elite team, 40 members, and because of my connections to law enforcement and the media, I was able to assemble a 40-member team. 23 of them are feds, 12 of them FBI. We have U.S. attorneys. We have U.S. marshals, customs heads. They've been fantastic. And they helped identify Mr. Rackstraw's 45-year trail in 21 American states, 5 countries including Canada, where he used almost 24 different aliases and identities and raised 3 families and while living in 6 careers. I mean, this man is off-the-scale genius. And that is one reason the FBI, he ran circles around the FBI.
And what of his background in Vietnam? Paratrooper? I mean, he sounds like an Audie Murphy type character with a distinguished flying cross. I think he won 3 of those or was awarded 3 of those.
He had 50 medals. He had 2 flying crosses, silver, bronze, 37 air medals. He was the pilot for the general that led the Cambodian invasion. The generals wanted this man because he was a daredevil, a go-to-hell jumper, and an incredible pilot. So he became everybody's favorite guy, one of the most recognized men. But he had some problems, and that is when he wasn't flying, he was a rule breaker. He went out illegally with the Special Forces and the CIA on missions, sometimes 2 or 3 days at a time. He was riding around in a stolen commander's jeep. He was a rule breaker. He was stockpiling weapons he shouldn't have. And finally, he lied about his rank and his education. This man turned out, when they looked at him, and those lies are the ones that got him booted after 7 years. This man not only didn't go to 2 colleges like he claimed, he was a high school dropout in the forests of California, up in the Redwoods. He was self-taught. He learned everything in a library. And he lied his way through the military. So that's why they booted him.
Despite his valor.
Correct. Yeah, it was a big decision. And it was 5 months before the jump that he came home to his family in Valley Springs, California, where he had a 24-year-old sister and his mom and dad in the general area. And his sister described to us that he was glum, he was angry. He wrote a letter to his commanders that the FBI later talked to the sister about. So you might say Cooper was known to have told the stewardesses, I have a grudge. He was asked if he had a grudge. He said, I don't have a grudge against your airline. I just have a grudge. Well, 5 months earlier, he told his sister he did have a grudge. He was angry at the military.
Did you personally interview Rackstraw?
We confronted Rackstraw. We tried for 6 months to get him to sit down because he was arrested, he was suspected in 1979, 78, but he was never charged as Cooper. So that was our entrance to reach out to him and say, look, we're doing a historical documentary on D.B. Cooper, which is what aired on History Channel. It covered a lot of different suspects. But we said, we want to interview you, and we want to talk about how you were wrongly arrested. That dance went on for 6 months. And finally, we confronted him. We went down with cameras, ambushed him at his boat shop, near where he had a boat at a yacht club. Poverty Sucks is the name of the boat. You'll see it on the photos that you have. And we confronted him. I had some former FBI armed with me for protection. We didn't know what we were facing. And you can go up on dbcooper.com and see about 3 minutes of the confrontation where he puts his foot in his mouth a few times.
And still, none of this is good enough for the FBI.
That's the sad point. The FBI had been working with us quietly for 3 to 4 years. We had a letter from headquarters. And when we were ready to turn in the 102 pieces of evidence with my team, they canceled the meeting the week before. And then they went on History Channel and announced the file was closed. A representative for the FBI, who was a liaison for History Channel, told us on camera, but it wasn't in the doc you saw, or anyone saw, he announced that, well, they're afraid of a circumstantial case. They're worried that old witnesses and any type of evidence could be corrupted after 45 years. Well, we were aware of that, and that's why I brought in the best team ever. We have great DNA. We have great forensics, and we have incredible witnesses. But the FBI won't look at it. They closed the file, and that's why 2 weeks ago, with my attorneys, I stood in front of federal court in Washington and announced we were suing the FBI and the DOJ to reopen the case.
Now, obviously, this book, The Last Master Outlaw, you know, is heavily lawyered because he's still out there, and you're accusing him of being D.B. Cooper.
We know he's Cooper. I honestly can say that. After, first of all, this is the investigative report that my investigators and former FBI prepared for their proteges. I mean, these are some of their mentors that put this together. When they refused to receive this, we transferred it to this. And this has 47 pages of endnotes. The writing was fun and difficult, but let me tell you, I'm going back to fiction after this.
I'll bet.
6 weeks, 13-hour days, and we got it in. And not one libelous thing in it. We got immediate insurance. And online, you can find Rackstraw posting under Airborne Bob, which is what they called him in Vietnam.
Right.
Email is posted saying, he can't find an attorney. 9 times he's asked for attorneys. He can't get one. So he's been threatening for 3 years, but the FBI and Bob hate this book.
And the FBI, it's a source of embarrassment because they had him 6 times, and they let him off the hook.
6 separate times. My favorite one is when he crashed he was flying a pilot from Michigan to California for an owner, crashed in Idaho on a farm. Farmer ran out, and he says to his co-pilot, "Don't say a word." And the sheriff shows up, the state police, and the FBI shows up. And Mr. Rackstraw talked himself out of that. That was only 2.5 years after the jump. And I wrote in the book, he convinced the FBI he wasn't the droid they were looking for.
Share with us some of the DNA evidence. Because this is in the era before DNA evidence. What do you have? Can you give us one piece?
The identity of Norman DeWinter that he hid in the Northwest.
Right.
We have witnesses that have, he mailed them 7 letters. We found a stamp from 1971 that has 3 alleles, partial DNA, that match a water bottle from a San Diego face-off we had with him with cameras.
Uh-huh.
An abandoned water bottle. We shared those 3 alleles, and we told the FBI, and again, they won't look at it. We also have, there's a quick Canadian angle to this. There were 3 letters mailed right after the hijacking from a D.B. Cooper. Ha, 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 you can't find me. You showed a letter with handwriting and numbers over it. That letter was written during the Super Bowl of football that you had in Vancouver. He was there 3 days after the jump, and he wrote that letter. We compared that letter to the airline ticket, and a leading forensic expert says it appears to be the same man. So if you believe those 4 letters were mailed by Mr. Robert Rackstraw, first and last were mailed within miles of his home, then that puts him on the airline ticket line.
Indeed it does. Wow.
It's and a lot.
So what's the next step then, Thomas?
Well, the next step is we hear what the FBI wants to do. Frankly, I don't think they're going to reopen the case. I have a producer partner who's shooting in Vancouver as we speak. He and I are developing the answer to that, and that is we are designing a TV show called The Trial of D.B. Cooper, and the jury will be the best jury in the land, social media. We're going to make it so that they can watch the trial, hear the evidence, and then the public will decide, is Mr. Rackstraw D.B. Cooper or not?
And, I mean, was he or is he, aside from, you know, being, you know, confronted by you and accused of being D.B. Cooper, I mean, is he a likable guy?
He is debonair. He is an incredible con man. And he's a nice guy. And I'll be honest, that's part of, you know, you always imagine a bad guy being a bad guy. This guy is charming. That's the word we hear from all of his victims and witnesses. And frankly, it was six of his women that turned him in.
Right, right. Yes, he left a trail of broken hearts, I guess.
Yes, he did.
And very quickly, we mentioned the passenger, Bob Mitchell. Did you ever go back to Bob Mitchell with a photograph of Rackstraw? And what happened with Mitchell?
Bill Mitchell was the only passenger, and again, he didn't know about the hijacking, that all three stewardesses had traumatic memory loss. That's been documented. He did not, because he didn't know about the trauma. He did not know what was going on. So we sat him down with a Portland sergeant on my cold case team with six pictures, and guess who he pointed at? Mr. Bob Rackstraw.
Aha. There you go. Another piece of the puzzle. Thomas, wow, congratulations.
Thanks, Richard.
Amelia Earhart and Jimmy Hoffa, do you want to take those ones on?
No, I'm going for Bigfoot.
Bigfoot. Hey, I can't think of anyone better. Seriously. Thomas, a pleasure. And once again, congratulations on The Last Master Outlaw.
You got it. We'll keep you updated.
I appreciate it. Yes, let's do that.
God bless.
God bless you. Thank you.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.